Cool.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. No me hagas reír because now I'm going to laugh.
Perdón, perdón.
Man. Okay. We're going to get through this podcast.
You can cut
oh,
it,
know.
Right?
I know. But it's always so much fun. Oh, man. Let's see if we can get through this podcast.
Okay.
All right.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Being Yourself podcast.
Welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. My name is Andres Intro. I am your host. And if you are new to the podcast, this podcast is all about exploring the different lived experiences of our many identities. I'm very excited about our special guest today and our conversation that we're going to be having, because this is an episode that I've been actually wanting to have for quite some time. And it's been in the making for a long time. But I am so happy to be here. Jolady Rosario, thank you for being here. Welcome to the Being Yourself podcast.
Thank you for inviting me and welcoming me to your space.
Absolutely. You know, you're always invited. My space is your space. And we're not talking about MySpace from the 2000s.
Although, you know, there was a lot of great things that happened in MySpace, such as learning how to code and things like that. So it was a great platform back in our day, I guess I can say now.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it had its thing. It had its moment. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But joking aside, again, thank you so much for being here. You know, for those that are out there listening, you know, I've gotten to know you for the past, I can't believe it's been what? Has it been about 3 years or so?
Yeah, about. Wow, time flies. Yeah, it's been about 3 years.
So I've had the absolute honor and pleasure to be, not only have you in my life and getting to know you, you know, working together. You know, we worked at Ringo College for a little bit, and even working outside of our professional work. So, you know, for those out there listening, what do you want to say about yourself? Introduce yourself.
Sure. That's such a loaded question. So I would say, a filmmaker. I'm a photographer. I'm an artist at heart. You know, grew up in the arts, theater, went to school for theater. I was born in Dominican Republic and came to the U.S. when I was really, really young, maybe around 4 or 5, as an immigrant, undocumented youngster. And, you know, my parents came to the U.S., particularly the Bronx in New York. So that's where I grew up, boogie down Bronx, which, to be honest with you right now, I'm so homesick living in Florida. And we came here. My parents came here to try to provide a better life for me and my siblings. And, you know, I grew up in the Bronx and currently now reside in Florida. And I've had a really long arc of living through so many different experiences that have brought me to what I'm doing now in terms of getting more heavily involved in the arts. And I've been in higher education in the DEI space for over 15 years, working in different higher education institutions. And so I don't know, maybe we can unravel some of those things that I said. But yeah, that's a little bit about me. I'm a young cat from the Bronx, you know, trying to live life and, you know, be as fulfilled and liberated as possible as an artist.
One of the things that I've really admired you about you is your dedication to when you say that, living your life in freedom and expression and all those kind of things. That's one of the things that really resonates with me when I think of you as someone who is just so in tune with themselves in terms of being free, being artistic, being out there and letting your full self be known. Obviously, being mindful of whether this is a safe space or not to be known, right? But just I've always known you that way, and I feel like that's one of the things and characteristics that I admire about you. Because at any point in time that I'm even with you, I've always felt really comfortable, at ease with being myself, right? And I think that's not something that is something that's not something that you find in many other individuals, and also to the same to the level that where you can feel comfortable being around someone like you and being able to be myself. So I think that's one of the greatest great things about you, and I wanted to share that.
Well, I appreciate that, because I feel as if sometimes that's so hard, like, quote unquote, being your authentic self. And I think, you know, I walk this life with a lot of insecurities. I think as a marginalized person, right, like I identify as trans, I identify as an artist, I work in DEI spaces, you're oftentimes in spaces where you have to walk against the grain. And sometimes that means you rub spaces in a wrong way, you create friction, you ask questions that people don't necessarily want to answer. People feel uncomfortable when you, you know, bring that there's oppression at the table. You know, and, you know, as somebody who, you know, presents masculine but also feels femininity, like always feeling a balance even between my own sense of like occupying a space as a not only as a trans individual but also as somebody you know, who always feels like I'm in the middle of things, I'm caught in between. I always call it, like, you know, lost in translation, right? Like I don't speak like I'm going to college, for example, I'll give you that as an example. Going from the Bronx to going to college, private institution, you know, where some of the messaging was, you know, you speak colloquial language, you don't speak in the ways that you should be at the level that you should be, or you're, you know, not writing at the level that you should be, right? Like, basically, the message was, you're not good enough, right? Like, you need to work harder. But then you go back home after your first year of college, right? And then all of a sudden, your language is shifting. You're maybe not code switching as often as you want. And so now in your own community, you're kind of being told what's going on. You're too white now. You're speaking white. You're talking white. And, you know, like, I feel like that's something that stuck with me my entire journey. Like, no matter what piece of identity we're speaking about, whether it is, you know, being a first generation college student and navigating going back home to, you know, being in an office space where you're trying to kind of, you know, create some progression, to create some equity, you know, to advocate for people like myself and others who, you know, have and carry marginalized identities. Hearing that you feel comfortable is an honor, because of the fact that I don't always feel comfortable in the spaces that I'm occupying. I always have to figure out how to live in my own skin, especially when I know that I'm creating friction, where I'm asking people to change behavior, or where I'm, you know, advocating for a certain, you know, policy or right that's going to create progressive, you know, institutions and organizations, or when I'm working with the leadership team, right? And we have, you know, most of the body of people might not look like me. So they don't think that there is anything necessarily wrong in terms of what they're doing. They don't have the muscle to reflect on maybe how their privilege might be impacting other people, right? And so what you're saying sometimes can still be weaponized against you, right? Mm. How you advocate can be weaponized against you. And I think because of the masculinity that I walk with, regardless of whether I embrace it or not, people still attach that to me. And so there's so many different pieces of my identity that I'm always trying to navigate that, you know, make me uncomfortable in my own skin sometimes. And that's something that I still wrestle with even to this day. But I'm happy to hear that you feel comfortable in that. And I think that's something of maybe a superpower that I think, you know, I've heard others, you know, say that I feel comfortable around you. And I'm hoping that I'm creating that for other people, because I always have to navigate what that means for me.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. And I think we all have something about ourselves that we, our identity, an identity or who we are, whatever it is that we might feel uncomfortable or we just are not as confident about, and we're always navigating. But I think that you know, for you, or, and I don't know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know, how do you feel like you've navigated that? Because thinking about all those different identities and not feeling safe at some points, or trying to navigate mm-hmm. that, you know, how do you create that for yourself when, because it's also, I think that the being confident and being that person to mm-hmm. lead the way in many perspects, right? And being that person to push the boundaries or push the doors down and for others, it's a lot of responsibility, it's a lot of weight on ourselves, right? But I think that you do it in a way so elegantly and like so just like really, and also in a very, I don't want to say this, like just very educational, very smart way, I guess. I'm trying to look for the word here, but it's just that obviously you never came across to me as just obviously if hostile or anything like that. Or we're having a conversation, and we've been in conversation in groups where we've had to have certain conversations and set some certain standards where there's community agreements and all those kind of things. But you do it in a way that it comes across as from an educational standpoint, rather than let me be, you know, I don't have to necessarily be that, I don't want to use a hostile word, but just that forefront kind of person.
No.
I don't know if that kind of makes sense or where I'm going with that. But.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it depends on like who's receiving it, right? Because I think, you know, I'm thinking back on some of my experiences where I definitely, you know, learned from maybe the ways I reacted in certain spaces, and, you know, and think back and say, you know, I could have done that differently. I could have shifted here. I could have maybe take ownership of these aspects that really contributed, whether it was impacting your team or maybe a decision that I made wasn't maybe thinking of the whole thing. Because I think even as people who are leaders, we have limitations, right? We all have our own biases that we walk with, or we all have, you know, limitations on how we see the world. We all walk with reflectors in front of our faces, right? Or binders, I should say. And so I think a part of my tool, or, you know, to answer your question, I think I have to remember and be rooted on why I'm doing what I'm doing. What is the purpose of me stepping into a room? What is the purpose of me advocating for this? And figuring out how I can best use, you know, my toolbox, right? Whether it is to be able to connect with someone, whether it is, you know, leveraging relationships, whether it is, you know, connecting to resource. I remember this supervisor that I had once said to me, "You're very resourceful." And I don't know how exactly how I should have taken that. That could have been both positive and negative, depending, you know. And I think over time, that is something that I think you get, that grittiness of coming from a place like New York City, where you have to figure out ways, you have to be creative, you have to, you know, be resourceful, right? Like whether it is a project, whether it is you're trying to finish something. So I think when I think about this, I have to think about what are my my resources that I have that I can utilize, how can I shift things? How can I be as flexible as possible? And then what, at the end of the day, like, how do I maintain purpose? Right. And also thinking about what are the compromises that I'm not willing to do that I know will impact people like myself, that I know will impact my siblings, that would, I know would impact the communities that I'm from, and staying connected to the community really keeps me humble in the ways that I do the work, right? Like, I don't think, I'll go back a little bit. As a student going to Dickinson College, you know, I try to navigate a lot of different things, right? And oftentimes as students who are advocating, sometimes we don't get to see the full picture of what's behind, of what an administrator is navigating. Or, you know, and we have this painted picture that once you become an administrator, right, you're disconnected from the mm-hmm. community who you're trying students. To help yeah. and support, right? Whether it's students, mm-hmm. and it could be the same thing in a nonprofit, right? Once you become an executive director and you're no longer, you know, in touch on the ground, working with the people directly, that you have these levels of separation from how you're conducting and doing your work, what your purpose is, right, gets misguided to like the people that you're serving. And so I think not only figuring out my purpose and trying to be, you know, honoring that, not only utilizing my resources, but then also thinking about like, how do I still stay connected to the communities that I know every time I make a policy or I'm in a room or I'm advocating for someone, I'm bringing those people because I just had dinner with them last night, because I was just at an event with them last night, right? So I think for me, being community centric is the way that I can stay grounded when I'm doing and leveraging the work that I am doing to make sure that I'm still on the right path of what I'm advocating for, what I'm saying in this particular room, because I want to make sure that my community is taken care of, right? And that community can be Latinos, it can be, you know, Black folks who are on the table that I'm at, you know, as somebody who identifies both Black and Latinx and Indigenous, I always have to think about what is the whole picture, and then also what are the gaps that I have. And so centering myself in the community is such a powerful tool, because then you're not speaking out of pocket and you're understanding, you know, what the community needs really are, whether you're serving students, whether it's outside of an institution, whether it's outside of your organization. Being part of the larger community and staying in touch is such a humbling experience that, you know, will take your career and your sense of purpose a lot further in life. Or at least that's part of my philosophy and my approach.
No, I completely agree. I like that you brought up grit. And for those that are listening, Angela Duckworth was a psychologist, I can't remember, something like that, who did a lot of research on grit. And it's a great, fascinating kind of, theory and all those kind of things, because it is true. And I think for those of us who have to endure, go through certain moments in life where things are not easy, when we don't have the same toolbox as many other individuals who have certain privileges. And so we have to work harder, and that allows us to, you know, maybe that's why you became so resourceful. And I think in many ways, I think I share that, because in my family, I'm the one who is the, everybody goes, you know, asking me for advice or help or whatever it is, because I'm the one who has all the knowledge and then I had to get there and it wasn't given. So I had to definitely go and out there and get it and find it. But I wanted to, you made me think about when we were talking about community and bringing those to the table. You know, one of the things that I've really enjoy about you, and when we're in this conversation and we're talking about community and we're talking about whatever, what group we're talking about, is that it's really important that if we are going to be advocating for a specific group of individual, that we have them be part of the table. Because in order for us to be able to do that, they need to have a voice. They need to be present for us to be able to understand their needs, and how we can best suit them. And I think that is something that even to this day, when we look at in all different spectrums of what's going out there in this country, whether it's with LGBTQ rights, whether it's with DEI, whether it's with immigration, whether it's whatever it is, I think that's something that I feel like when I'm looking at the news or when I'm looking at whatever program and they're interviewing or whatever they're doing and they're having a debate, I always think about, okay, but where is the actual person? Why is that that you're referring to, that the group of people that you're referring to, and why they're not at the table?
Yeah, I think that's part of that community-centric philosophy, is that you're not just speaking for folks who can speak for themselves, right? And I think that's a part of learning like when to lead and when to follow, leading in certain spaces when you have leverage, but also creating, you know, space for folks who maybe don't typically have access, you know, giving them that platform to be able to utilize that to speak their truth, right? Or speak about their experiences so that decision making can happen differently. When I think about this and I think about what you just said in terms of grit, and thinking about even my latest experiences, right? There are sometimes also people who don't care, right? And so that grit is kind of part of our survival. I think about grit is really survival, is an edginess, is, you know, problem solving skills. And sometimes that's insufficient. Not because you don't have the grit or you don't have the space, but this just space is just not, you know, full of leaders that would, you know, honor that, right? And be dismissive of who you are, you know, in the name of power or whatever it is that's, you know, driving them. And I'm thinking about my experience, particularly in New College of Florida, right? And, you know, you have an institution that's a public institution. And, you know, I was serving as the chief diversity officer there. And you had, you know, the governor of Florida, you know, inputting, placing, right, conservative board of trustee members who centered themselves as knowing what was the right thing to do for the community that they continuously ignored when that community was speaking about the things that they wanted, the things that they needed, why they attended New College of Florida. They came into a space that wasn't theirs, right? They came into a space without knowing the history of the institution, you know, with a particular agenda of what they think the truth is, right? What their conservative values were, and completely shifted an entire community. And so you have those folks who came into a place that was not their own with a particular agenda and, you know, totally shifted, right? And overpowered, exerted their power, you know, fired me, you know, abolished the diversity office, you know, the Office of Inclusive Excellence and Outreach, you know, and continuously get rid of folks who are not in alignment with their beliefs and values. And I think that's a really great lesson for all of us to think about when we're talking about advocacy, when we're talking about bringing people in. If we're not listening and we're coming in with an agenda, and we're overpowering, exerting our power, that community piece is lost, right? And so I think as individuals, sometimes we also have to think about who are the people that we're working with and what flexibilities they have in order to figure out and pivot in ways that we can use our grit to, you know, make transformative power, right? In that space, I didn't have any power to be able to change things, right? And I have to think about what are the ways that I could have shifted, right? And the power that I had was working with the community, right? You know, continuing to do education in the community, continuing to do DEI work in the community, continuing to do arts work in the community. And sometimes we have to pivot out of spaces that are not safe and are no longer sacred to us, right? And I do hope that in the future, you know, New College and, you know, all of the community members that were hurt in the process, you know, that could be healed. I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but I think that's a really great model to look at, like, what's the wrong thing to do when we're thinking about being community centric and doing this kind of work. It's so important to, you know, like you said, place that person to be heard from their perspective and their lived experiences. And sometimes you have folks who don't care. And I think we're living in a very interesting, polarizing political climate at the moment where we've kind of lost touch with, like, being human with one another. And I think that that's something that we need to ground ourselves back into in order for us to actually have, you know, dialogue and be in community with one another. Because if not, I think, you know, the path that we're leading is going to be destructive. It's already being destructive, right? And so that's scary. But it's also, you know, when we look at back at history and think about, you know, immigrant movements, thinking about, you know, movements where leadership really had to look different, thinking about, you know, really grounded grassroots campaigning, you know, getting el pueblo together, getting people together. I think it's a really great moment for us to be reunited in ways that I have not ever experienced before, right? And so while the path looks a little dark, there's still a lot of folks that can step up. And so if you're stepping up, thinking about how are you including folks who don't look like you, who maybe have slightly different perspectives, in order for all of us to actually do positive impact in a more holistic and communal way.
I think that when we think about DEI, and you've worked in DEI for a lot longer than I have, or have had much more experience than I have, and you've devoted a lot of your professional career through DEI work, and mm-hmm. even to this day, you know, you decided to go ahead and start your own organization, you know, which I would love for you to speak about. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, I'm taking everything that you just said to me and thinking about DEI. And it makes me feel that I think a lot of people just have a very wrong, or just they don't really understand the point mm-hmm. of DEI. And I think the way that you just phrased it for me, and maybe it's just because I've also haven't had a lot of experience, but I think, you know, what is that misunderstanding that you might think that people have about what really DEI it really is? Because to me, it is about bringing everyone to the table and allowing everyone to have a voice and allowing everyone to have equal footing and allowing everyone to succeed just as much as everybody else.
Yeah, and removing barriers so that people can succeed, right? So I think mm-hmm. that's a really big part. I think the misunderstanding is a couple of things, right? I think is the miseducation of what it means. I think it's become now a political jargon, you know, for folks to, you know, either dismiss a legacy of work or maybe, you know, honor a legacy of work. It's such a politicized field right now at the moment that's really under attack. But I think it gets grounded in miseducation, not knowing what exactly we do as, you know, officers of diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging work. And also feeling like it's just a, you know, a black and brown space, like it's only for people of color or just for queer people, right? And so it becomes this polarizing things when it's misunderstood or you're not a part of it or you feel like you can't walk into a space to learn. And I think when I think about that work, what I'm saying is here is a place that we can come in dialogue and wrestle with really tough issues, right? To become more informed citizens, to fulfill a democratic, you know, vision of what the America is supposed to be, right? But in order to be a true democratic society, you also have to learn all sides of truthful history, all sides of how people are marginalized, all sides of how people are impacted, so that you can be a better informed citizen and go off to whether you're a doctor, whether you are, you know, a DEI officer, whether you're in politics and in government, right? All of this information about the community that you are serving, especially when we're looking at the growing demographics of America becoming more Latino, more Black, right, more brown. Because of these things, the communities and folks that you're going to be interfacing are going to be maybe different from your own identities. And so how can you make sure you know factors that impact those particular communities, right? And we can break it down, whether it's health disparities, whether it is economic disparities, whether it is educational disparities, all of these kinds of different factors that influence life and you know, the things that we bring, the luggage of our life, but also how we communicate, right? Because we also communicate very differently. In an individual basis, you know, when you're a part of a collective, you could, you know, it's kind of like you're code switching no matter where you go, whether it is within your family or within your friends, right? So learning that language helps you be a better professional no matter what field you're in. And I think that that is what is not listened to. And maybe part of it is that as DEI officers and folks who are in this field, we're so in the work that sometimes we haven't maybe, whether it is lack of resources, maybe not having marketing skills, and maybe some of us do have marketing skills, so I'm not negating that, but maybe we haven't been able to tell the story fully for people to really comprehend. And maybe this is a moment that we can start sharing what those that success is. You know, we're so often just moving on to the next project or the next thing or the next policy that we don't take time to celebrate, but also communicate that success to the community so that folks can be educated on what's really happening holistically. And so I think maybe, you know, it's a failure on all of us, but it's also, you know, a moment where there's a grab of power. And right now we're seeing a very scary shift in America that, you know, we might be losing a lot of our democratic values. And so it's a scary time as well. And so, you know, hope has to be at the center, you know, for and DEI, unfortunately, right now has to be at the center of figuring out like how to guide to make sure that, you know, we as a society maintain our democracy.
No, I agree with you. And I wanted to also talk about mosaic movements, right? Mm-hmm. So you took all the experience that you've been having within DEI and what happened with New College and decided to start your own arts organization that's focused on DEI with LGBT, BIPOC. So talk to me a little bit about that and what brought you to wanted to do that. I know you love the arts and DEI work.
Yeah.
I
think that it's been a really long journey and a long year and a half of like figuring out where I'm supposed to be in the next chapter of my life. When I came to Florida, I came here as the inaugural director and, you know, associate dean for the Center of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Ringling College of Art and Design. And I took the job because I was so excited that it was an art school. I took the job because I'm like, oh my God, like, as a director that's coming into an art space, like, can you imagine the magic that could happen when you have, you know, a cultural arts center and DEI at the center? And so that was my vision, right? Creating a space where students would get the resources and support that they needed, that staff and faculty would get the training and the support that they needed. But also to reimagine what DEI spaces can look like when you add arts to it, right? Because arts have power. It has power for freedom of expression. It has power for us to be able to enter a conversation with our, you know, with guns down, not fully loaded, you know, kind of in, you know, high on our seats, you know. And I think sometimes when we talk about very difficult conversations, art just eases the tension, right? Because it gives you something to focus that is not directly, you know, about people being on different sides of the table. And so I think that's so empowering of the arts. And I think, you know, growing up as a kid, it took me such a long time to even embrace myself as an artist. And even, you know, now today, like, those are things that I wrestle myself with, because I think it coming from a Latino family, when you hear something like, I'm going to be a student of the arts, that is something that is not well received, right? Like, mm-hmm. growing up, the messages were, you know, you have to be a doctor, you have to be a teacher, you have to be a police officer, you had to, you know, be all of these kind of very stereotypical confinement of what being a professional meant, right? And so the arts was just, the arts is not a profession, it is a hobby. Right. And so I grew up with that. So the fact that I loved poetry, the fact that I was in theater, the fact, you know, I went to a high school that was fashion industries high school, where I learned illustration and graphic arts design. But, you know, through that, it was always like, yeah, you're doing this, but you're going to college. Right. And I think that that connection to college, even though, you know, my family didn't know what that really meant, as a first generation student, I had to figure all those things out myself. Right. The college piece was, you're going to become this other thing that is very specific, right? And so I remember actually my first year after I completed my first year at Ringling, I went back to New York and I stayed with my dad over for the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. And I remember for the first time he said, "I don't really know what you do. Like, can you pretty explain that? Like, it's such a alien language, right? Like, it's something that they can't conceive because it's not so easily put in a box, such as you're a lawyer, you're a police officer, right? It's very easily recognizable. And you know, and I'm in the field of diversity and inclusion, but telling my dad, like, yeah, I do this work, but I'm also an artist, I'm doing a documentary, I'm doing all of these things, was such a difficult conversation even for me to have, because I just, like, always didn't talk about it. Because I didn't have the language of how to translate that in a way that was conceivable and tangible for them. And so, you know, my artistic journey has been a very disruptive one, right? So I started out in fine arts, you know, graduated from Dickinson College as a theater major. And my goal was I was going to be a theater artist and I was going to go back to New York. And we hit the market crash between 2008 all the way down to 2010 and et cetera. And I graduated in as of class of 2010. And now I'm giving out my age. but it was so difficult to be an artist in New York City, especially a theater artist, where most of the opportunities were really, you know, you volunteering or having some sort of fellowship and internships. And I did them all. I worked in film festivals. In theater festivals. I worked in small nonprofit theaters, you know, and the most that I could get was a Metro card to get to the location. Forget about getting paid, right? And here I am as a young professional, just graduated from college, trying, you know, I had my first son, you know, I was with my partner. So here's a family of three that I have to, you know, feed. And I couldn't find a job. It was so difficult. And I think that all of the resources that I had, you know, I was part of, you know, an organization. I was trying to work with the career center. And it was like everything was catered to if you're going into corporate work. And that was just not me. Right. And either it was education or corporate work. And so, or nonprofit, right? And the nonprofit work that I want to do was the arts. But the connections there were really not there for me. And so I kind of felt a little bit lost. And so I had an opportunity to go into higher education, and I've been in higher education ever since. But every single place that I've been at in higher ed, I always had some sort of thing happening after school hours, right, in the arts. And so I worked for a theater in Pennsylvania for a very long time as a stage manager, as a lighting and sound operator. And I could just never find a footing for myself as a person of color, queer artist, just trying to be like, my dream was, I want to be a director in theater. And I just was not getting the opportunities. And I'm sad that it took me this long, right? Because when I finally got to Ringling, I was like, this is my moment. Like, we're in a Mecca. Sarasota is supposed to be a Mecca of the arts. And this is like when I can go back. Because I, after having such a bad experience, well, I can't say bad experience. I'll say it like this. I had an amazing experience working with a theater in Pennsylvania, but I couldn't break into what I really wanted to do. And I felt like I worked there for so long that I expected them to at least give me an opportunity to become a director or to direct my first play, because I felt like I at least deserved for all the work that I did. And I didn't get that, right? And that was not good or bad, but it just pushed me away from the arts, and I took a break, and I took a very long break. And so coming back to Sarasota was that, like, that fire, because I think for me, the arts feed me and feed my soul. And so for a very long time, I felt a lot lost. And so coming here to Sarasota and reconnecting with that, you know, doing documentary work, working with photography, now I'm actually finishing my second play, And so I feel a little bit more fulfilled. And it took, you know, all of the negativity of having bad experiences in higher ed, you know, having unsupportive environments. But it took me being displaced for an era, for a space that I, from a space that I really loved, to figure out like, what's my next chapter in my life. And I haven't necessarily quite figured it out 100%, right? This is the things that keep me up at night. I'm still working in DEI spaces. I'm still working with community. But for me, the reason why I'm starting Mosaic Movements is because as I'm starting this journey to get re-in touch with my artistry, it is something that I'm finding so much difficult. Let me go back. As I'm trying to center myself back in my artistry and to start this organization, I am finding that there's a lack of resources and information for artists. It doesn't matter whether you are an artist of color, if you're queer, if you're white. However, for artists of color and for LGBTQ artists, there's a really lack of resources, right? Whether it is grants, whether it is a lack of like accessibility to them. And so for me, Mosaic Movements is going to maybe help fill in some of those gaps, right? Like I'm learning what it means to start a nonprofit. You know, I'm learning what it means to do an LLC. I'm learning, you know, how do you do e-commerce? These are all things that I'm learning. How do you put an artistic resume together? How do you, you know, write an artist bio? And maybe some of us are way more advanced in doing that as somebody who's a practicing artist, right? But I'm finding that there's gaps, right? That there's things that I can't take as shortcuts because I need to learn so that I can share their information with other artists who I'm meeting are also navigating similar things. Like, how do you sustain yourself as an artist in a way that's authentic, in a way that is financially secure, in a way that you are able to take your artistry and get access to funds, both to live and survive as an artist, but also to thrive, right? And so I'm hoping that with Mosaic Movements and all of the efforts that we're doing, we're trying to do an artistic hub of resources, and we're starting with an initiative called Creative Nexus. And we had a soft launch about 2 years ago. And it was an attempt to try to get BIPOC and queer artists together to network. And it was a really amazing event that really left some impactful impressions for me and really opened my eyes as to like, maybe this is actually a good thing. Maybe I'm heading the right direction. And, you know, since then we received a grant from the Life Music Society in partnership with, Forgeryville and WSLR radio station here in Sarasota. And I'm so excited because this grant is to create a Creative Nexus Summit, which is basically going to be a 1-day event where folks of artists, BIPOC artists and queer artists can come, you know, get a headshot so that they can use professionally, but then have opportunities to partake in conversations, whether it is a panel, whether it is workshops, to learn, you know, how can you get some business essentials as well as professional development to take your artistry to the next level, right? Thinking about like, how do you start your own website? How do you learn from some of the artists who are actually doing this as a full time? How can you get to that full time stage if this is what you really wanted to do? And in some ways, I'm also learning and doing this myself. But I'm also wanting to create that platform where others can share resources, but also be a part of the dialogue to make sure that other artists are able to be successfully, especially now in the state of Florida, when we're seeing a huge budget cuts in the arts. A really important time for folks for all of us to be able to provide these resources. And I think sometimes we have a lot of organizations that have a lot of things happening, but not necessarily a lot of resources in our particular area, that are actually like teaching those skills to ensure that artists are actually, you know, growing, with those business essentials. I know that when I went to school as a theater artist, I never took a business class. I never talked about like, how do you become a full-time freelance theater artist? That was never part of the curriculum that we were taught. It was, here's acting, here's directing classes, here how you, you know, costume classes. So it was really about the direct practicing of the art form, but not necessarily like, if you don't find a job as a theater artist, as I shared with you in New York City, where it's so competitive, and I'm not an actor, right? I'm a director. I'm trying to envision what the world that I'm creating on stage. How do you do that in a very selective area? And sometimes that means you have to start your own thing. And so I wish that when I was in college, I had those same skill sets, or at least that I was given that education so that I can think about how do I become an entrepreneur in the arts to be a self-sustaining artist. And so I'm hoping that while we're also doing work and presenting work and bringing performances and all of these things, this Creative Nexus series of events, which we're going to be opening with a concert and also doing some artist conversations and talks and workshops before. And we're also going to be doing a youth summit because we also want to make sure that youth are a part of it. We just want to make sure that folks are given the correct resources and connected. And I might not have all of the answers, but bringing the community together, the panels and other practitioners, I think collectively we can come up with answers that folks can take and, you know, they can start planning in a way that's honoring their art and how they want to live their fulfilled lives. So that's what I'm hoping to do.
No, I love that. And I think it's great that one, you're creating a platform to support, others in the arts and BIPOC, LGBT, because you live that gap, you live that experience of there being that gap of not being that support there. And I think it's wonderful that you decided to give it back. The other thing that really comes to my mind is, following your passions and the things that you really love to do. I think as an educator, you know, I work as a career counselor, and it's one of those things that I'm always trying to navigate with a student, because I agree with you. And I even have my own personal experience of having to find a career that is fits within those boundaries, that box, right? And I think, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for it, whether it's culture or whether it's, you know, historical events. You know, I know, for example, and I know this, that we, during the crisis of 2008 to 2010, 12, whatever, you know, a lot of families struggled, and their children, when they decided to go to college, they were very, very, very purposeful in terms of what careers they wanted to go, because they wanted job security. So I get there's a lot of components to it. But I think to your point, and from what I'm getting, is the importance of finding something that it is brings you joy, that it is a passion, not just a vocation. Because a vocation is not always going to be sustainable in the long run in terms of your own happiness and in terms of what you want to do. Sure, it can provide the money, but at the end of the day, you also have to figure out how to live your life, right? So I'm glad that you kind of, you know, went that full circle and came back, and now you're doing what you wanted to do. And then that's a big thing to try to navigate, going from, you know, being a chief diversity officer to now decided to run your own organization and try to navigate that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this can feel very glamorous, right? It's kind of like, oh, this person just had this job and had this realization and now we're doing it. And it's like, it's rough. It's tough out here in the streets, right? Like I don't have all the answers, right? Like I, you know, we're filing our paperwork to become a nonprofit. You know, we're very early on in our stages. And so those growing pains are real, right? Like accessing funding, you know, being able to do this as a paid full time. Like I'm still doing all of these other things to put food on the table, to be able to pay the bills, right? Also trying to utilize my art. So, right, I'm still teaching. I'm still doing my consulting DEI work. I'm still, you know, driving Uber sometimes. I, you know, again, it's going back to survival mode, right? Having 20 million jobs and different projects. And I'm saying this because I watch a lot of YouTube, you know, to learn. I watch, you know, a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts. And I think oftentimes we talk about the success, but not like the pains of like how to get there. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, I had a board and I was like, oh, maybe I don't have the right people on our board, you know? And, you know, and right now I think we're getting to such a much better place. I think I have a team that's really behind me in many ways. I'm still building that team. You know, I'm working with organizations who believe in me. It took a long time to figure out who the right partners were. And, you know, having the Peace Education Action Center, and Orleans Sweeting, as well as Fogartyville, you know, WSLR has been a gift for me in figuring out like how to change and pave the way. But, you know, let's not get it all twisted, right? Like the access to funding is such a really difficult part. And it is what breaks and makes organizations. You know, I think you hear a lot of business statistics that within 5 years, people fail. And, you know, I'm determined not to fail, you know, and I'm determined, you know, to continue to grow, to continue to make connections, to build relationships, right? And that's the stage that I'm in, right? I'm learning as I am going, trying to connect to people who know more than me that can help me along my journey. And sometimes, you know, I get dimes and nickels, and sometimes I get someone who fully embraces the vision. And, you know, that's all a part of that journey. But that journey comes with a lot of rough, you know, obstacles in the way. And, you know, I see the ending being a totally successful that we'll have our own building in the future. But, you know, we're in route. We're in route, and I am determined not to let anything, you know, move me. And I think, you know, for the first time, not only doing this, but also, you know, actually, you know, centering myself, right? Because I think there's a lot of mindfulness practices that I'm doing, whether it is through my photography, doing street photography, doing portrait photography, doing video work, doing production work. So those are all things that I'm also learning of, like, this is tools that I have in my toolbox that I can actually use to make my life sustainable, right? So those are things that I'm offering people now, photography sessions, you know, production, you know, event photography. That I always maybe took for granted as a skill that I had, that is still connected to the arts. And now I'm really realizing like the full potential of having some of your artistry actually, you know, meet commerce. And that's, you know, where maybe where the starving artist ends is when you figure out the magic of really doing what you're passionate about in a way that's not capitalistic, but where you can financially sustain yourself, right? Like that commerce has to be a part of the ingredient. And I think when we figure that out, you know, you can really live in your art. And so that's in the journey that I'm in now. So I want to make sure that folks, when they hear this, is like, it's not a glamorous walk to success. It is kind of a drunken path where you're stumbling across things, where you're trying to get some clarity and, you know, making those relationships and those, you know, learning and self-educating and learning from folks who have experience is so crucial in this journey in order to be successful. And so I'm hoping people can hear that and say, like, if you're having a hard time, like, so are we. And you're not alone in this journey. And so, you know, take that with grace and give yourself some permission to know that this is hard. This is hard. Starting an organization is hard. Being an artist is hard. You know, but it has its wealth of peace and, you know, a sense of liberation, right? Because when I do photography, when I do theater, when I do production and I have that final piece, I feel so, I don't even know what's the word for it. Like, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I hope that everybody can find that place.
I love that. Love that. I know we're reaching our time, and I think that was a beautiful way to end our conversation. But I think that one of the biggest takeaways for me, hearing the journey, and I'm going to go back to that word of grit, because I feel like it's just such a central theme to the conversation that we've had, and that strength, that resilience, that perseverance. You know, that growth, gotta learn how to get through it, fail. Sometimes you're gonna fail, but you just keep on going and you keep on knocking those walls and don't stop.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully maybe within a couple of years, we can come back to this conversation and see where we're at as to like all the different pathways that led us to that place of success. Because, you know, having, I guess, different chapters that we check in is so important to like not glamorize success, right? And so, you know, I thank you for inviting me to the space. Thank you for sharing, you know, allowing me to share a little piece of myself. And you're doing such an amazing, important thing for us to talk about our identities and, you know, how our lives are being impacted and how we're navigating and surviving, you know, to live, you know, in our own skin. And, you know, full circle is, you know, this is hard. But, you know, when we get to those aha moments, it's such a beautiful place of peace. And I'm hoping, like I said, for everyone to be able to get to that sense of, I got this and I am who I am and it's okay for me to be who I am. You
know? Absolutely. I agree. It is okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. I have You're had welcome. A pleasure and I look forward to many more conversations with you.
Likewise.